This is Heritage Unbounded, a podcast series of the Cultural Heritage Management Graduate Program in the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences Advanced Academic Programs at Johns Hopkins University. Join us as we keep our finger on the pulse of heritage in our changing world. We will talk with leading heritage professionals in the field and discuss the biggest accomplishments and challenges of heritage today. I'm Sarah Chacon, Director of the Cultural Heritage Management Program and your host for Heritage Unbounded. Today's conversation is with Corey Wegener, Director of the Smithsonian Cultural Rescue Initiative, or SCRI, an outreach program dedicated to the protection of cultural heritage in crisis situations. SCRI's work includes U.S. domestic and international responses to disasters in countries like Haiti, Nepal, Egypt, Syria, and Iraq. SCRI also offers a disaster response and leadership training for cultural heritage stewards worldwide. Corey has spent many years working on cultural heritage disaster preparedness. Before coming to the Smithsonian, she was an associate curator in the Department of Decorative Arts, Textiles, and Sculpture at the Minneapolis Institute of Art. During a concurrent career as a U.S. Army Reserve officer, Corey served on several military deployments, including her last assignment as an Arts, Monuments, and Archives officer in Iraq after the 2003 looting of the Iraq National Museum. In 2006, Corey founded the U.S. Committee of the Blue Shield, the U.S. branch of an international NGO dedicated to implementation of the 1954 Hague Convention for the Protection of Cultural Property During Armed Conflict. It is my pleasure today to be joined by Corey Wegener.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to get us started by asking you to tell us a little bit about what the Smithsonian Cultural Rescue Initiative is and a little bit about what your role is in the organization.
Okay, great. Well, I'm the director of the Smithsonian Cultural Rescue Initiative, and it's an outreach program that the Smithsonian created around 2010 with our experience with helping out after the Haiti earthquake in 2010. And we work in a few different areas. We work on cultural rescue itself and helping colleagues respond to a disaster, whether naturally or human caused. We also have a research arm, an awareness raising arm, and then we also have a pretty large training capability as well that we do both domestically and internationally.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize about the research arm. What kind of research do you guys do related to that?
So we work on some projects related to mapping cultural heritage in disaster situations and long-range monitoring of that and trying to describe and discuss some of the contexts in which cultural heritage is damaged. We have a program called the Conflict Culture Research Network, which is a number of institutions. We co-chair it with the University of Pennsylvania Cultural Heritage Center. It's a long-range project to create a database that researchers can use to look at the root causes of damage to cultural heritage sites in armed conflict.
Got it. Oh, so more specifically in armed conflict situations.
Yeah, for that particular program. But the idea is that through what we learn in our responses, and, you know, we always learn from our colleagues as well, that we apply that to improve and create best practices for this emerging field of disaster response for heritage.
So give us an example of the kind of situation, because the first thing you mentioned with the cultural rescue piece, a kind of situation where you would have gone in and what kinds of things you would have done.
Yeah, so for instance, with the Haiti Cultural Recovery Project, we had Smithsonian received a request from colleagues in Haiti to come and assist them. And we went and we helped with damage assessment and to try to figure out some programs that we could do sort of on the job training with our colleagues as they went through the rescue and salvage. And so that was a really large-scale project where we had funding from the U.S. government and also private resources, and we were able to create a cultural recovery center in Port-au-Prince where we did training, but also where we helped stabilize collections. We had conservation labs that we created there and to help stabilize and rehouse collections in preparation for reopening of museums as they were stabilized.
Do you then do, and this might be the training piece you were talking about, then do you do work to help them in anticipation of the next, because they live in an area where things can, like that can happen again?
Yeah, that's exactly what we do. For instance, in the recent Beirut blast, we were contacted by colleagues from Blue Shield Lebanon, and we provided advice to them. We didn't actually go to Beirut. We gave advice, and we did a follow-up training with a group of volunteers with Blue Shield Lebanon about paintings in historic homes and how to do recovery, stabilization, and rehousing of those paintings. You know, we're not conserving them. We're right now trying to get them into a safe place until the building is fully repaired. And so projects like that, we try to look at what our colleagues want and need from us and respond in that way as best we can. But yeah, it's often, okay, you've just been through this terrible disaster. Let's see what you need to do for the short range recovery. We don't do long-term building projects and things like that normally, but you know, okay, let's do some disaster training now to get you better prepared for the next time.
Now, are there, Corey, are there other organizations like this, or is this pretty unique?
Well, at the time we got started, it was definitely unique because while there are a lot of training programs out there, at least in the U.S., and then there are organizations that do sort of the more long-range recovery. Think of organizations like World Monuments Fund. You know, they help over the course of a number of years to rehabilitate historic site or building, et cetera. But that immediate response after a disaster, there are not very many programs that do that work. And so we were trying to fill a gap, really.
Who do you typically get contacted by? Is it typically governments? Is it your Heritage colleagues around the world? What kinds of groups reach out?
Yeah, it just depends. The Smithsonian has a long history of working internationally. We work in, you know, more than 100 countries around the world for various projects. But one of the big sources of our connections internationally is actually on the National Mall with the Folklife Festival. And there's always an international component to that. And so, for instance, that's how we had the really close contact with colleagues working in the Ministry of Culture in Haiti, who reached out and said, "Oh, we know you. You're our colleague. Can you come and help us?" And so that's often the case. The same with the Bahamas. We had Hurricane Dorian in the Bahamas, and my boss, Dr. Richard Curran, had close colleagues that he worked with on a Folklife Festival that featured the Bahamas several years ago. And he reached out and said, you know, how might we be of assistance? And we came and we did a damage assessment. We were supposed to do a training last year, but of course that's been postponed, as so many things have had to be. So that's kind of our mode of working, is colleagues reach out, whether it's through government or it could even be through associations that we are part of, like the International Council of Museums or others, where we've met people and then they reach out to us.
That's interesting, the relationship with the Folklife Festival. That's really great to see.
Domestically, we have the American Institute for Conservation. So it's the Foundation for the American Institute for Conservation. And they have the National Heritage Responders Program.
Okay.
Which I'm also one of the National Heritage Responders. And so that's a group of volunteers who are conservators, collections managers, and they have a hotline that small institution, well, you can be a big institution too, but the institutions can call for advice and help, and even have some National Heritage Responders go in person to provide assistance after a disaster. So that's another response mechanism. And then UNESCO has an emergency fund, and they have some capability to provide emergency response as well, but not a lot of staffing for that. And so it takes them a little while to get things pushed forward.
And then, do you work much with FEMA?
We do. So FEMA is the Federal Emergency Management Administration, and the Smithsonian has an MOU under which we co-chair with FEMA the Heritage Emergency National Task Force. It's like public-private partnerships. It's agencies, government agencies, as well as nonprofit organizations and a number of public service type organizations that are interested in cultural heritage protection from emergency situations. And we put out information. We gather information about damaged cultural heritage after disasters. And we've got a pretty big project to try to create some mapping that's available to better understand disaster situations afterward, to be able to reach out and contact organizations. We'll work with the state SHPOs and other state organizations to put those maps together and then to do outreach to find out about damage. So yeah, we've been working on that relationship for, I guess, about the last 5 or 6 years. It's been really fruitful as part of the larger U.S. disaster response framework.
And do you do training with them as well?
We do. We have a training program called HEART, Heritage Emergency and Response Training. And that is a program that we do together with our colleagues at FEMA. And that's been going on for about 3 years.
Fantastic. Wow. This is really great. The scope is larger than I had first realized. So it's wonderful to hear about all these connections, both international connections and on a national scale as well. I'm going to pivot just a little bit and have you talk a little bit about the 1954 Hague Convention, about how this relates to the work that you do and how it relates to disaster risk management.
So the full title is the 1954 Hague Convention for the Protection of Cultural Property in the Event of Armed Conflict. So it's quite a mouthful, and it usually gets shortened down to 54 Hague. The 54 Hague Convention is the first ever international treaty dealing exclusively with the protection of cultural heritage during wartime. And while a lot of people say, oh, it was as a result of the damage of heritage during World War II, it was actually kind of in the works in between World War I and World War II, and unfortunately was kind of paused during World War II, and then finally ratified during the big conference in The Hague in 1954. It's also considered customary international law, even for those countries that aren't a state's party to the treaty. And it's one of the several conventions that are administered by UNESCO. However, unlike other UNESCO treaties, the 54 Hague Convention is a law of war treaty, and so deals with the limitation of the use of force in armed conflicts. And here, the limitation, the Geneva Conventions is also the law of war, which limits harm to civilians and non-combatants. And the Hague Convention limits damage to property, and specifically in this treaty, to cultural property.
As heritage professionals, it might not be something we run into all the time. So how did you, Corey, become familiar with the 54 Hague? And what does that, does it have play any role in the kind of work that you do now?
Yeah, so I first became aware of the 1954 Hague Convention when I was an Army officer in the civil affairs. My civilian job was as an art museum curator. And as an Army reservist, I was an arts, monuments, and archives officer. And I was a bit aware of the Hague Convention, which actually sort of helped create the modern day Monuments Men. Looking back at World War II and the successes the Monuments Men had there, the 54 Hague Convention actually has a section that says states should create this. And so I was serving in a position similar to that when the Iraq Museum got looted in 2003. And so I was deployed to Iraq and then quickly realized how much I didn't actually know about the Hague Convention. And I certainly set about the task of learning more and understanding more about our responsibilities under this law of war treaty.
SCRI then has a relationship or an MOU with the U.S. Army, doesn't it?
We do. So fast forward, you know, to the present day, I've been spending a lot of time over the years since my retirement from the Army Reserve in trying to help the U.S. military better understand what is cultural property. How do they know what to protect if they don't know what it is? And also on the cultural heritage professional side, trying to better explain to our colleagues around the world how to give information to the military that will help them to protect and comply with the responsibilities under the Hague Convention. So in 2018, we at the Smithsonian signed an MOU with the U.S. Army Civil Affairs and Psychological Operations Command, USACAPOC, which is located at Fort Bragg. And USAKPOC is the Army Reserve unit that has overall responsibility for Army Civil Affairs, but also the much smaller subset of the Heritage and Preservation Officers, what are currently the modern-day Monuments Men and Women. And so we're providing training opportunities for them, working with them on cultural property protection planning, and thinking about how to train the rest of the U.S. military about this important treaty.
Obviously, COVID has had a big impact on all of us that are doing training and education and learning in the field of heritage. Has it changed the way you guys approach the training that you offer or the folks that you're able to offer training to?
Yeah, it really has, because it's so much of what we do for training is hands-on. It's doing things like learning how to do documentation, how to plan for and execute an evacuation of a collection, doing salvage work, things like that. So a lot of our programs, we just made the decision to put it off until such time as we could do it, not really realizing how long that would be in a lot of cases. One of the toughest programs that's impacted is our work in Iraq. We have a number of projects that we work on in Iraq, and we haven't been able to go there for over a year. And so, you know, working with people online is great, but it's really hard when you can't work face to face. But we have been able to keep some things going online. I mentioned the Beirut training a while ago. We figured out ways around it. We have a program called Saving Your Family Treasures that we do at disaster recovery centers here in the U.S. after a federally declared disaster. And we did a Facebook Live version of that last year after the Easter tornadoes that we put online. You can still watch it online, and we kind of repost that after a disaster that's happening now. And it's basically, you know, handing off from person to person, demonstrating how to do these, you know, collections, saving, you know, cleaning things up after they've been wet, dry, how to dry things, that kind of thing. And it's not perfect, but it's what we can do. And then on Friday, we went ahead and we had a local museum suffer a pipe burst disaster. And I and a few of my colleagues from Scry went ahead and masked up and went and helped them do the salvage in person, because we felt that we could protect ourselves, and we really wanted to help them as best we could. So sometimes if it's not too dangerous, we can show up in person. But
we're headed back in that direction, hopefully. So that's,
yeah, I'm so looking forward to it, because I have not met any of these Army Monuments officers that I've been with. Well, not any. I've not met many of them. We've been doing our training online. We're really hoping to be able to convene ourselves later this year and do a full-on exercise and get to know each other a little better.
Fantastic. That'll be great. Now I'm looking forward to that. Any kind of activity, right?
You're invited.
Kind of, even people looking forward to activities, I'm looking forward to.
I know, right?
Exactly. Now, a little earlier, you mentioned Blue Shield, and I know that you're involved in the U.S. Committee on Blue Shield. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is, what they do, and a little bit of the work that you do with your organization?
Yeah, so Blue Shield International is an organization dedicated to implementation of the 1954 Hague Convention. It's kind of like the Red Cross is to the Geneva Convention. It's the symbol of the Geneva Convention. The Blue Shield is the symbol of the Hague Convention. And it's an international symbol. It's a blue and white shield that can be placed on a heritage site, a museum, a historic building, and also on heritage workers who are engaged in the protection of cultural property, and even military forces that are engaged in protection of cultural property. Just like you see medics wearing a Red Cross, you might see military personnel wearing a Blue Shield. The Blue Shield International is the organization, and then there are national committees around the world that are also dedicated to the same thing, implementation within their own countries. And we all work together as the Blue Shield movement In the U.S., the Blue Shield has typically been involved with training military units preparing to deploy internationally, providing basic information about the Hague Convention, that kind of, you know, ongoing training. But the really big thing we were involved in was getting the United States to actually ratify the Hague Convention. Because believe it or not, even though the U.S. was very involved in the drafting of the Hague Convention, we never ratified it. And it wasn't until 2009 that that finally happened. And so the U.S. Blue Shield's main job was getting the treaty ratified. Now I think our main job will be to start looking toward ratifying the protocols that are associated with the convention, which the U.S. hasn't done yet.
Now, is that the kind of organization people that are interested in these kinds of topics can become involved in?
Yeah, absolutely. We are a membership organization, and the funds that we get from that membership, we put right back into the organization to be able to do the work we do. It's an all-volunteer organization. We don't have a staff or a big footprint of overhead, but we do quite a bit of advocacy and awareness raising and trying to get people to better understand what the convention is all about.
I'll put links to the Blue Shield in the text for the podcast, so in case people are interested in that. You know, we've talked a little bit about some of the work that SCRI does and Blue Shield. And what are you seeing, Corey, as some of the greatest needs in the areas of disaster risk management? What are the biggest needs, first of all, but then also threats? Where do you see most of the kinds of disasters that we're going to see moving forward in the next 10, 20 years? What are those kinds of things that we should be anticipating?
Well, it's been a really terrible decade, of course, for the intentional destruction of cultural heritage, which we've seen happening a lot in the Middle East and other places. And so that sort of preparedness for armed conflict and having organizations think about what's the worst case scenario and plan for that. And we've seen, you know, it's been heartbreaking watching colleagues deal with that kind of situation in Iraq and Syria, Afghanistan, Libya, etc. So another big challenge is going to be climate change and thinking about this, you know, what I used to think of as a slow moving disaster is here, right? So understanding extreme weather events that are of longer duration and how to prepare for that and mitigate the damage and having people understand the sort of science behind disaster risk management, thinking about what are your hazards you face where you are and what's the likelihood of that hazard happening and how vulnerable are you to that or your organization or even you as a person. You make those kinds of decisions every day, right? I'm going to go get in my car and what's the risk that I could get hurt driving in my car? Well, you know, it depending on how fast you go, et cetera. But I also can mitigate that risk by wearing my safety belt, by complying with the speed limits, et cetera. So you take measures to mitigate your risk. And overall, we still make a decision to get in our car all the time because we feel the risk is pretty low. Well, it's the same thing with institutions, thinking about, you know, if my risk is flooding because I'm right next to the river, maybe I can eliminate my risk by moving farther away from the river. But if I can't, can I create better drainage systems, make sure I have a sump pump, don't store the collections in the basement? So those are the factors. And I think that just better education for cultural heritage professionals about risk management is really helpful. And then, but if all else fails, you also need to know how to do the rescue part too.
Yeah. So if I was at a small institution, a lot of small institutions have limited resources, as we all know, and today, even more limited resources than they may have had a while ago. What would you suggest or where might they look to get started in the process and to get started thinking about these issues?
Yeah, well, you can go to the SCRI website and we have a lot of different resources on our own website. Get some training. Go through either, you know, apply to go to the HART course. There are Alliance for Response communities that are headed up by the FAIC around the country. then also, you know, talk to your staff and make an emergency plan. Even if you haven't had specific training, there are resources out there about emergency planning. And just sit down and think about your risk and what you can do to avoid it. Have an emergency plan and then actually practice it. Don't just put it on paper and leave it on the shelf. Rehearse it. Set a little budget aside to buy emergency supplies. Check your insurance. Make sure your insurance covers collections, not just the building. We've seen that a lot in recent times where museums didn't have the right kind of insurance and there was no help for their collections. And your whole mission is about the collection, right? So it's great if they'll come in and fix your building up, but if you've lost your collection, then your mission's kind of down the tubes, right? So thinking about these things, and they're not comfortable things to think about, but thinking about the worst case scenario and what you can do to prevent it is the real key.
Well, thank you. That's very helpful. We'll post some of those links to some of those resources in the text for the podcast text. What do you see as the greatest challenge or the greatest barrier that's going to be the hardest thing to overcome?
I think the hardest thing to overcome is that lack of applying resources to disaster risk management, because it's a kind of an intangible thing in a way, especially for collections institutions. It's not an exhibition. It's not a capital campaign where you're doing something cool to the building you could put someone's name on. But just kind of having the staff responsible for that remind the leadership that they need their buy-in and they need that small amount of budget to make sure that they're adequately covered in case of a disaster. And I think it's such a cheaper thing to do to plan ahead and pay for some of that planning and having the supplies and the resources available, having those maybe contracts in place where you get a mitigation company to come in and help you versus the loss of your collection or having to do the conservation to the damaged collections costs 10 times as much as that little bit. You know, it's the old adage, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Yeah.
And it sounds so trite, but it's so true. And you see it happen over and over again. It's like, gosh, if we just wouldn't have stored the collection in the basement, it wouldn't be underwater now. The thing I'm most hopeful for is that message appears to be getting out there better than it used to. And what I'm excited about is seeing a whole new generation of cultural heritage professionals seeing this as a career path. You know, you didn't used to meet very many people who are responsible for disaster risk management planning for cultural heritage. And now there are several places that you can get a degree in cultural property protection, which is more focused on the armed conflict aspects, and also in disaster risk management for heritage. And so that's an exciting thing to me. And I used to kind of feel like I was alone in the world doing this kind of work. And now there are so many up and coming colleagues who are making it a career path.
That's wonderful. And that's fantastic to hear. And that's a great place to leave it. That, you know, a lot of our students are also interested in the topic. And it's one of those things that, you know, what we've seen over the last 10 years, what we're looking forward to in the next 10 years, it's something that's important and folks have got to pay attention. Corey, this has been a really fantastic conversation. I'm going to give you an opportunity to say any last minute things you want to toss out there.
No, it's just been great talking with you, Sarah, and I'm looking forward to seeing where your program goes in the future.
Thank you. Thank you. This is fun.
Spread the word and invite your friends and join us again next time for another episode of Heritage Unbounded, brought to you by the Cultural Heritage Management Graduate Program and the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences Advanced Academic Programs, Johns Hopkins University. Podcast music features the piano instrumental Gonzaga Gaucho by Mark Staub. Thank you.